Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, one and all, and a warm welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference, and to the first episode of Series 8. Can you believe it? I can't. I'm Joe Haddo, and wherever you are in the world, it's a pleasure to have you with us, whether you're a new listener to Book Off or one of our old friends. And if you've never listened before, well, let me tell you what we do here. We invite two authors onto the podcast to talk about their work, their writing, their lives as writers, and they then go head-to-head in the Book Off. This is where each guest will get 3 minutes, and no longer, mind you, to pitch us a book that they love and think that we should all read. And after hearing both pitches, I will then decide which book wins. You, of course, might have a different opinion. So let's meet our two authors on this first episode of Series 8. My first guest today is the author of 2 poetry collections and 4 novels. His writing has appeared in various literary journals, and Entertainment Weekly listed him as one of their 10 new Hollywood next wave people to watch, ladies and gentlemen. Here to tell us about his brilliant new novel, Hell of a Book, it's Jason Mott. Hello!
Hey, how's it going?
Really well. Lovely to have you with us. And I'm a big admirer of your headphones there, Jason, which I think we'll come to talk about very shortly. And my second guest is a critic, journalist and author who is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. She's known for her hilarious pieces about Britney and, one of my faves, Werner Herzog. And her work has featured in The New Yorker, The Paris Review and The New York Times. Here to tell us about her debut novel, The Life of the Mind, it's Christine Smallwood. Hello and welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's my absolute pleasure. We can't all be in the same room because of something called COVID, but I should do the virtual introductions. Jason, Christine, Christine, Jason.
Hi, Jason.
Hey, good to meet you.
And you're both joining us from America. I'm over in London in the UK. Christine, you're in Brooklyn. How is it over there?
It's nice out today, a little overcast, but, you know, no rain, so that's good.
And what about you, Jason? Where do we find you?
I am in Wilmington, North Carolina, so southeastern North Carolina, where it is hot and humid all day, every day.
Mm-hmm. No change there.
Nope, never.
And coming back to those headphones, I mean, I thought I had some pretty snazzy headphones going on, but you have, I think you win the prize already on the headphones.
Yeah, I tried to find the biggest headphones I could find, so these are winning the contest. But they're really good quality, though, so it's like, why not?
They look comfy as well. They look like that, you know, you could just spend all day in them.
Yeah, they are. They definitely are. They're for, like, you know, music primarily, but they work great for interviews as well, so...
Well, as I said, over the next sort of 40 minutes or so, we're going to talk about both of your books, which I absolutely loved. I can't wait to get into a discussion about them. And we're going to hear what you've been reading lately and get to the Book Off a little later on. So, Jason, if I could start with Hell of a Book, because there's a mention of radio interviews in the book and how the cadence of the questions and answers are all the same. So I'm going to try and be pretty original for you. Okay, what's your book about?
There you go.
I'm joking.
So yeah, no, that's great. I love it. So So Hell of a Book is a story of an author on book tour. He's just written a really large book, and he's traveling around the U.S. trying to go about the business of selling his book and doing interviews and meeting readers. And along the way, he meets this 10-year-old boy known simply as The Kid. And The Kid keeps appearing again and again at these locations, and the author begins to wonder if he's actually real or not. And then there's also in the news this discussion of this young boy who's been shot by police, and the author is trying to discover, is this kid somehow that same boy? There's a lot of blurring of reality and fiction in the novel, but the author ultimately comes into this discussion about race in America and black identity and black lives in America.
And you said you sort of used the word blurred there. I read it as a sort of blurred fiction in the sense that it's also, I read a letter to a sort of younger you as well.
Yeah, very much so. It was definitely me, like it's a fiction, it's under the fiction heading, but it is semi-autobiographical in a lot of ways. So the project was me really trying to come to grips with what my life in America as a black man has been and like all the different points and how it has changed and affected me. So it was me kind of talking to that younger version of myself, trying to explain to him all the things that he's going to have to learn to deal with and make it, find his peace with as he moves through life. So that's kind of how it worked.
And I want to come back. I want to talk about, well, many things, but 1994 being one of them. Before I do that, Christine, The Life of the Mind is, I mean, it's a very powerful book. Both of these books are. And I want to also discuss the powerfulness of both of these, but with the humor as well, which is something we'll discuss later. But it opens on this sort of no holds barred description of a miscarriage, and it just, the first few pages had me just not knowing what to do, if I'm honest, Christine.
Did you want to put it down?
No, I don't think I did, but I did, I sort of, I suppose I thought I could skip a few paragraphs.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always like, I,
and you know, I mean that, like, you know, I don't mean that negatively, right?
Oh no, yeah, no. I mean, I figured if people could get past the first like 15 pages, then they might finish the book. But I definitely figured some people would put it down. I was on a family group chat with my husband's family when the book came out, and you know, his uncle sent a text to, like, you know, I don't even know who was on this chat. There were like 15 phone numbers, and I don't even know whose phone numbers they were. And he was like, "So excited for Christine's book! We're going to start it tonight." And then no one ever followed up on the chat again.
That was it. Was it?
And
that
was like, the last. Oh, I guess. I was like, I guess Uncle Max didn't get past the first page. That's okay. I mean, it happens.
So was the sort of part of the intention there then to almost to ensure that the reader was, you know, was ready for the rest of the book? Is that why you did it?
I mean, I would like to say I had a reason, but it was more that the novel began as a short story, and the short story was really just the first 12 pages. I mean, when I went back after I had continued on and kind of tried to make it into a novel, I did go back and have to like edit, obviously, and move some things around. But it just began there because that's where it always began.
Yeah.
And so it, I wasn't, you know, it doesn't bother me if people don't want to keep reading, but it wasn't like an attempt to shock or something like that.
No, and it's also very important to the story, which we'll come on to as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Jason, where did the sort of germ of the idea for Hell of a Book come from then? Was it always going to be a novel, or was it potentially going to be nonfiction?
Yeah, it was always going to be a novel. So it started back in 2013 when my first novel, The Return, came out, and I was on book tour for that for almost 2 months. It's really hectic, bizarre, wild kind of process. And it was also very comedic, and so I wanted to write a comedy about an author on book tour to kind of poke fun at publishing and poke fun at, like, the book tour process. So I wrote it, and
is it really as grueling as you write it?
Oh, God, it's terrible, yeah. Like, physical book tour is the most insane process ever.
We just think it's probably quite glamorous to be like, I'm swanning from hotel to hotel.
There's no glamour anywhere involved in the process. It is a new hotel in a new city every day for weeks. You don't get to eat anything. You don't get to see anything. You don't get to hang out with friends. It's just place to place to place constantly. There was a period of like, I think it was like, I went 13 days on the road without ever coming home. Then I came home and I was home for 16 hours and then back on the road again for another week. And like I said, people are like, oh man, you went to Philadelphia. I was like, I think I did. Like, I went to some city that might have been Philadelphia, but I was only there for like 10 hours, so who knows where I was. So yeah, I wanted to kind of capture that insanity and that kind of craziness into a novel. And then it eventually evolved into this discussion about race as, you know, there was just so many strings of shootings and so much in the headlines that I wanted to kind of figure a way to talk about that. So it became this comedy drama about, you know, authors and about America. So,
which I just think is not only incredibly clever, but just incredibly important as well, because I think we have to have the serious journalism about these problems. We have to be able to watch these news reports to sort of know what's going on. Yet I think this way of talking about it is just really refreshing and just as important. Do you think the same?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was definitely my goal. It's like, I didn't want to, I mean, it's such a heavy topic for me as a writer. Like, I didn't want to bury myself, because there were times when like the writing got really difficult because it's such a difficult kind of topic.
Yeah.
That the comedy actually helped me as a writer with my emotional state, because I wanted to have some days of writing where I actually just laughed at what was going on. So the comedy became a way to help me get through it, and eventually I hope that would help the reader kind of get through it as well. So yeah, it was just fun also being as absurd as I wanted to be for a while. Like, so many of my novels before have been rather grounded, and so this one, it felt good to just go completely over the top and scenes that, like, I was like, there's no way this, my editor let this stay in here, and then somehow it did stay, and it's like, oh, awesome. So it was just a lot of fun.
I'm so glad you also had fun writing it, although I imagine, yes, parts of it were hard, because it is also so fun to read, I think, and that's, and I'm so glad that that was part of the process for you. Christine, we've mentioned, I think, Dorothy, who is the protagonist of your novel. Just tell us how she came about and a little bit about her for those that haven't read this book yet.
Okay, so my book is about a woman named Dorothy, who's an adjunct professor. So she's finished her PhD in English, and she's now kind of looking for a job, you know, every year applying on the job market and not finding anything. And then the book is set sort of in the direct aftermath of her miscarriage. So the kind of miscarriage she has is, you get this information kind of retrospectively, but it's, so she's already had the miscarriage, and then, but she's continuing to bleed. So when we meet her, she's in like day six of this kind of ongoing bleeding. And so the book is really about her sense of things ending, but never really being over, and kind of what it feels like to live in that place of kind of limbo, both with her professional precarity, her body, and then there's, like, you know, all of us living in 2021 spent a lot of time thinking about climate and the fate of, you know, I learned recently that it took thousands of years for the dinosaurs to go extinct. Maybe you guys already knew this, but I was reading a book with my older son, and it just really crystallized something for me, because I was like, oh, okay, so this is taking thousands of years. Like, that's what this is. This is our thousands of years of going extinct. And that really is kind of what my book is about, which makes it sound very heavy. I think it is. It also tries to be fun with these totally light themes about, yeah, precarity and miscarriage and the end of everything.
Yeah, right, that's it, yeah. I mean,
buy my book.
The thing is, you're talking about it, and yeah, I'm smiling because it isn't, you know, here's a question for both of you, really, because I think that, you know, there's a sort of brutality to both books, and there's serious themes and messages in both of them, and yet they're just they are enjoyable to read, and there is a sort of wit and a humor to them. So a question for both of you, Jason, I'll ask you first. Would this book have ever been written without the humor, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would argue that the book has already been written without the humor. I think there, yeah, are, because the conversation, like, I'm not bringing anything new to the table. I think I'm trying to present a new perspective to this conversation. But the actual conversation itself has been, you know, it's a conversation that's been written about for decades, you know, hundreds of years, honestly, of American history. Like, it's a conversation about Black people in America and the faith that they have. So yeah, it already exists without the humor, but that was where I wanted to make it different and make it unique in adding in that humor, which became a very, again, part of my kind of spin on life and my spin on the topic, to add that part of me into it. So
yeah. And Christine, same for you, because this would have been a very different book without that.
Yeah,
wit,
I mean,
wit.
It's funny. Like, I don't really know how funny it is. Like, I'm I get a lot of different feedback about the book. Like, some people find it really funny, and I think some people find it really depressing. And that's like a sweet spot for me, you know, like where true despair meets comedy. But while I was writing it, I have to be honest, I wasn't trying to, like, I was trying to make the character extremely vulnerable, and she's kind of cringy. And like, so I just kind of just went towards that as like hard as I could. And then it turned out that the result was this like thing that's fun to read and that's funny. Hmm. And so I wasn't like, it sounds like Jason kind of enjoyed writing his book. Is that right? Yeah, like I didn't enjoy writing my book. I was very, I felt extremely abject while writing it. It was also my first book, which maybe is a totally different experience. So the kind of stakes of like failure felt really like pressing, but maybe those stakes are always there. I don't know. But yeah, I guess I'm just saying that I'm glad that people find it funny. I do, when I read it out loud, giggle. Mm. But while I was writing it, I wasn't like, oh, this is like a great moment. You know, I was more just like, am I describing like the shame and humiliation of this as concretely and specifically as I can?
Yeah. And actually, it's interesting you're talking about that, because I think depending on who reads the book and where they're coming from, Dorothy will read as a different character,
yeah,
as either someone who's perfectly normal or someone who's like a bit dysfunctional. And I wondered totally. If that was sort of part of her creation.
Yeah, I mean, I thought she was perfectly normal, but I have learned that she's actually like deeply dysfunctional and maybe like a narcissist or just like a lot of interest. It's just really interesting. Like, again, like Jason, I think, has a lot more experience with this, but putting a book into the world, you really do learn a lot about what's there in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And it's funny, like, I just want to say, like, I don't think anyone ever enjoys writing a novel. I think it's impossible to enjoy writing a novel. Like, there are definitely moments that I, like, working on a hell of a book, there were days that were fun, but it's like saying, you know, there were days of clearing in, like, the winter of whatever. Right. It's like, it's just this horrible winter you're in for months, and right. You get, like, two sunny days. Like, oh, yeah, that was a good day.
Right.
But, yeah, like, getting a book out into the world, I know for me, is very strange because it... And I think it never gets less strange because, like you said, you have this vision of who the characters are and how you see them and how you think readers are going to see them. And then your readers get back to you and they're like, oh, no, this character is insane, or this character did this. I can't believe the character was actually doing this. And you're like, wow, what does that say about me that I see this is totally fine and totally normal, and other people are freaking out, or like, it's like, oh, OK, something interesting there.
Yeah,
there is something about it, you know, a book going out into the world, though, because and. I've had this conversation with a lot of authors when they say, you know, it really is sort of then out of your hands, mm-hmm. by the fact that you've written it and you've said what you wanted to say, or, you know, but how it's perceived and the different readers, you know, it's like, that's, you can't do anything about that, right? That's just the way it is.
Yeah. I think that's one of the tenets and like one of the big secrets of writing is that, like, every reader, and one of my writing mentors told me this, and I found it to be very true. He said, every reader comes to the page, and the first question they ask is, how is this actually about me? Mm-hmm. And that is what they always look for in the books that they read and things they read. It's like, it's never about what the author wants it to be about. It's about them as the reader and their life, and how does it talk to their lives? And that's how you get that personalization where you said X, but your reader goes, no, I saw Y, and this is actually about Y, and I've decided that forever now.
It's so true.
And you kind of just go... Yeah, right. Okay, that's
yeah,
cool.
You have to.
Yeah, and then the a great book, many people can find themselves in it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely right. I referenced 1994 earlier because it's referenced in the book, Jason, as being a good year. And, you know, I love just think back to that time when I was young and buying music and not having to worry about anything. I was like, yeah, man, that was a great year, 1994. And then hearing... you talk, Christine, about sort of the extinction of dinosaurs, and I said, this is literally what happened the other day, right? I was looking out of the window of my flat. It had been sunny. I mean, it is August when we're recording this. It had been sunny, and then it turned into a sort of biblical shower. And it had been doing this for the last few days. And I turned to my wife and I said, the planet is dying. And it was like, I just don't know where it came from. And we were like sort of half laughing at my doom and just from nowhere. But equally, it was like, yeah, I think it's a strange time to be alive.
Yeah. But we know so much. It's such an interesting time to be alive, right? I mean, the dinosaurs, I'm thinking about this dinosaur thing a lot. You know, like on some level, of course, they knew that their climate had changed, right? I mean, they had to like by instinct move to different areas, like eat different kinds of food, you know, blah, blah, blah. But we have, you know, of course, our like punishment of consciousness, and we have to like actually know everything that's happening. And it's just, it's a really interesting, scary, but also kind of neat position to be in. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to think about the dinosaurs. I did not know that fact, so thank you for teaching me that. It's really interesting. Because, you know, your brain just like the meteorite hit, then a week later everybody was dead. It's like, no.
No, do you know how it happened? I'll tell you. So actually, so the meteorite hit, and then it threw up these huge clouds of dust mm-hmm. that blocked out the sun. Mm-hmm. And so it took like a really long time for the plant eaters to. So the plant eaters all died out, and then the meat eaters died out, right? And of course, like some of them didn't, and that's why we have birds and like blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But like, That process just took many, many generations of these huge, they were so big also.
Yeah.
They were so big.
That's fascinating. So I will speak to Joe's point, like the idea of, I think I'm always kind of a little bit, so there's this idea that like things are worse now than they ever has been. And I think existence, human existence has always been challenging. Like, it feels more magnified because we're living through it. It's like, it's happening to you and it's happening to me. So it's like, obviously, you look at human history, it's like, oh, things were so much simpler then. It's like, no, things were never simple. Like, you can walk outside your house right now with the light on, and yet maybe there's a certain degree of danger at a certain night, but like, you're not going to get raided and pillaged by Vikings or anything weird like that. Like, you know, the monastery is not going to get burned down tomorrow. Like, there are all these things that we think of as, oh, things were so much simpler then. And then you actually go back in time and you've got Romans, you know, in around 200, 300 BC, you got Roman writers saying how, oh, things were simpler back then. And it's like, no, things have never been simple.
Back in the Ice Age, true. When yeah, all exactly. we had was hand-to-hand combat with exactly. saber-toothed tigers.
The good days yeah. were just with a stone and a stick trying to make fire. And it's like, yeah, those are great times.
Yeah.
But you're so right. And actually, I just, because I was a kid in like 94, I romance it a bit, because you know, I didn't have any worries. I didn't really know what was going on in the outside world. I just wanted to know when I could afford my next record that I could listen to like 50 times, you know. And so it's funny, yeah, you're right. And but people who were adults in 94 and sort of living it mm-hmm. probably are like at the time thinking, oh god, I wish I lived in the 60s, you know. And just the last word on dinosaurs for now. I just the other night watched this making of on Netflix about Jurassic Park, the film, and I loved it. And it also reminded me just how amazing Jurassic Park is. So if you're in a dinosaur phase at the
it's
moment,
really
Christine,
yeah.
check this thing out on Netflix of the making of Jurassic Park.
I will. I definitely will.
What a film. I always like to ask my guests what they've been reading lately, because we as writers are also readers, of course. And I know that when you're writing, sometimes you choose different things. But is there something, an author, a book, more than one that you've been reading recently that you want to tell us about? Jason, what have you been reading?
So I tend to reread a lot of old things, but like I read Matteo Scarpore's Black Buck a few months ago, and that was really, really good. Love that a lot. The other thing I've been reading a lot is the book I'll talk about during the book off period, the book I want to defend and argue for. So I'll talk about that in a minute. But I honestly reread a lot of old stuff. So I read a lot of John Gardner again recently, a lot of James Baldwin, reread a lot of his works about, you know, the black space in America and things like that. So yeah, I think that's where I am right now with reading. I don't read a lot of new stuff, but I read a lot of old stuff.
And that's interesting. I've definitely been delving. I mean, I read a lot of new stuff, and thank goodness, because it means I've got to read your two novels. But I also delve, back into a lot of maybe sort of 40s, 50s stuff as well at the moment. And I think there's a strange escapism about that, maybe, that I need. I don't know. Talking about, you know, romanticizing the past, I guess. That's what I get from those older books.
Yeah, I think for me, so part of the reason why I reread familiar things is when I'm writing new material, like if I read new stuff while I'm writing new stuff, it bleeds in, and I try to prevent that by reading stuff that I know. Like, it's like comfort food. Just read the thing that you know, and it the things there that bleed in are very different. So I try to kind of isolate myself when I'm reading, when I'm writing something new. So that's a lot of why I don't read too much new stuff, because I'm always writing something. But again, like Black Buck was probably the last thing I read that was new, and I just love that one.
It was great. It's really good, isn't it? What about you, Christine? What have you been reading?
Let me think. So I recently wrote a review of Tao Lin's new novel. So I was reading Tao Lin's other books for that. So like I read Trip for the first time, which is his book about psychedelics, which is really interesting. And I went back and I read Taipei and then his new novel, which is called Leave Society. And I thought that was an interesting experiment. And then the other book, let's see, I was very fortunate to get a sneak peek at Sally Rooney's new novel, Beautiful Worlds, Where Are You?, which is coming out here in the fall, which I loved. So I read that in galleys and thought it was just such a treat. Just a delight, really. I just loved it. And then I am reading Miranda July's novel, The First Bad Man, from like 5 or 6 years ago, which I really like. And I never read it before, but it has a therapist character. And my novel has two therapist characters. And I was like, wow, I'm really glad I didn't read this Miranda July book before, because I think it would have scared me out of writing my own therapist characters. But it's delightful to encounter them in this other. I feel like the book kind of speaks to me in different ways, but I'm really, you know how sometimes if you read something at the wrong time, then it will actually be like an obstacle instead of enabling. I'm liking it.
So unlike what Jason was saying, was sort of, you know, not reading, you know, new books whilst writing, in case that influences into the page. You were saying that if you'd read Miranda July's book, perhaps you wouldn't have written those characters.
Yeah, I think I would have felt like, oh, someone already did this, which is silly because, of course, somebody has already written a therapist character in a contemporary novel. But somehow, like, not knowing about this particular therapist character, I could just sort of, like, ignorantly go on my way, you know, making my little jokes, you know? And now I can, you know, enjoy this other. I wish that my therapists could meet this therapist and all, like, get together in some, you know, metafictional party, but I guess I'll write a short story about that and send it to the New Yorker. I don't know.
There you go. That's exactly what I was going to say. I'll be looking out for it in the New Yorker. Jason, you said that, you know, you got the idea for Hell of a Book when you were on your sort of first book tour around the States. And I wondered if that has been different for this book, obviously, because we have been living through this pandemic, we're doing so many things virtually. Have you been out and about with the book, or has it all been online?
No, yeah, this book tour has been really weird. I mean, different. I won't say weird, but it's been very different just because it has been completely virtual. Like, I have not done any in-person appearances. My publisher is still very leery of sending me back out, sending any authors out on the road, which I totally agree with. Like, especially now, like, there's cases rising again. It's all getting very weird again. So yeah, it's been different. Like, there's a positive component to it in that is you get to access a lot more people in different ways. Like the virtual events, I think you actually get more people to actually come out to virtual events because it's just clicking on something rather than being at a certain place and time. And yet at the same time, I really miss meeting readers face to face. Like, there's nothing like shaking someone's hand and talking to them about writing and talking to them about your book in person. Like, there's nothing like that.
Yeah, because, of course, at the end of a virtual event, now the positives, as you say, is that they become global events, essentially, because if someone's read your book in Australia, they can still come to the event by that click. But what you don't get is often at the end of in-person events, there's a signing part, and there's, you know, people come up to meet you to get the book signed, and you have that interaction and stuff. And that, at the end of a virtual event, it's kind of like, bye, you know, and then the screen goes, and that's, you know, it's a bit, yeah, it's strange, isn't it? It's just, there's pros and cons.
Yeah, I'm hoping that by next year I'll be able to go, when paperback comes out, I'll be able to actually go on physical book tour again and meet people. I mean, because after, you know, a year and a half in quarantine now, we're all just dying to meet people again and just be around people, I think. So hopefully things will get better.
I tell you what, though, you're going to be even more tired than you were from the first one because we're so out of practice.
Exactly.
You're going to be knackered. Well, I hope you make it over here. Come and see us in the UK. That'd be great.
I hope so, too. Thanks.
And before we do the book off, Christine, are we allowed to just talk about Werner Herzog very quickly?
Oh,
please do.
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I think the piece that you're referring to, I wrote 11 years ago. So I'm not sure what I can say. Why don't you tell me what you think about Herzog?
I would just wanted to... The only reason I bring him up is because I'm a sort of... Do you know Werner Herzog, Jason?
I'm a massive Herzog fan. Like,
right.
Very much so.
Okay. Then this is brilliant because I have only really got Herzog over the last few years. Right? And I've seen interviews with him from the 70s, 80s, and then I've seen more recent ones, and I've watched some of those classic Herzog movies, and I've watched some of his new stuff like Family Romance LLC. I'm just fascinated by the man now, and I just think he is... He doesn't call himself an artist, does he? He calls himself like a soldier, I think, or something. I just think such a creative. I don't know. There's just something so... He just does what he wants and he puts his mind to something and he sort of doesn't give a shit what anyone thinks. And that is just very inspiring to me.
Have you seen the one where he eats his shoe?
No, I haven't seen the one where he eats
his shoe.
Jason,
you've seen that one, right? You've seen that one?
I've heard about that one. I have not seen it yet.
He loses a bet and then he cooks his boot and eats it.
I haven't seen
that.
That's
cool.
That's
something a man would do. I mean, like, not to make it... That's a cheap joke that I just made, but it just does feel that way to me. Like,
yeah,
I mean, there's some truth in that.
You could do that, or you could also not do that. And
yeah,
that would be fine, too.
But if anyone was going to eat their shoe, like, there's a multiple choice test of, like, which person here ate their shoe in a bet.
Totally.
Like, Herzog is the top of that pick.
Totally. He's a marvel. I just wanted to bring him up. I know you haven't, you know, it's not like you write about him every day or anything, but you had written about him. And I'm obviously in a Herzog phase at the moment, I think, much like you with the dinosaurs. And I'm finding going back and exploring his work just really, really inspiring at the moment. I'm just really enjoying it.
Well, there is kind of a connection to the stuff we were talking about before, because he made the movie about the cave paintings at Lascaux, right? And like,
yes,
that is, you know, one of the things we have from the first humans, right?
There you go. See, we've brought... you've, like a true journalist, you've brought it full circle.
Deep time is like the most interesting thing. I mean, I've also been with my kid, I'm reading about the Ice Age, and it just like really puts our lives in a lot of... I mean, I've been just thinking so much about how brief this journey is.
Yes. And I read just the other day, right? This is this, and then we'll move on.
Okay.
I read that we live for an average of 4,000 weeks. And we spend so many of those weeks just doing like things that we don't, just sort of living, but like not really doing anything that we want. And it was an article about a focusing on how every week you should do something for you. You should do like something that's out of your comfort zone. Because, you know, many of us have only got about 2,000 left now. And it's like, as I read that, I thought, I need... What can I do? What can I go and do for myself now?
It's really a lot to take in. Like reading about the dinosaurs and the Ice Age, it's just like a lot to take in. But I'm glad we wrote our books, you know, and can talk about them, because that also means something.
It does. It absolutely does. And now it's time.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And to talk about other people's books, because it's time for the book off, and this is where each of you is going to get 3 minutes on our clock to tell us about a book that you love and that you think that we should all read. And I'm very careful to never say your favourite book, because I just don't think that's fair. I couldn't answer that question, or if I did, it would change week by week anyway. And I do think also there's a difference between a book that we should all read and a favourite book. I think that is a different distinction. So we need to do a bit of admin to find out who's going first, who's going second, etc., etc. But first of all, let's find out which two books you're putting up. So, Christine, what is your choice for the book off?
I chose The Copenhagen Trilogy by Tove Ditlevsen.
Fantastic. What about you, Jason?
I chose Monsters by Barry Windsor Smith.
Great. Okay. I'm excited to hear these two. So, Christine, would you like to go first, or do you want to see what Jason's got and then
I want to
second?
See what Jason's got. I want to go second.
Oh, terrible, terrible. Totally unfair.
Jason, you get 3 minutes, which you don't have to use, by the way, but
I'm sure I won't. I'm sure I won't use all
Well,
three.
You never know, because I've had a lot of people say that, and then when it gets to 3 minutes, they're like, I haven't even started yet. when we get to the 3 minute mark, I will either be honking you out or ringing you out with a school bell. Now, which one would you prefer for your 3 minutes?
The honker. I think the honker would be most attention getting.
A very good choice, sir. A very good choice. All right. So me and Christine are going to be quiet now. We're going to hand the reins over to you, Jason. And it's 3 minutes on the clock if you want to use them all to tell us about Monsters. Over to you.
All right, cool. No pressure, though, right? So Monsters is a graphic novel. So if you're looking to sound cool when you talk to your friends that you're reading graphic novels, this is one of the best choices you can go for. It is by an artist named Barry Windsor Smith, who I have followed for literally my entire life. He began doing his art in comic books back in the 50s and 60s, late 60s, early 70s. But he inspired a lot of the contemporary versions of what we think of Conan the Barbarian and even X-Men and things like that. And then he got really into a lot of Arthurian age folklore and mythology, like really beautiful, highly detailed images of that work. And so he's been writing Monsters apparently for about 30 years and drawing it over and over again, restarting it, failing and starting again. So it's kind of become his magnum opus. So it is the story of a soldier who goes off into World War II, post-World War II. And he's the subject of a bit of a weird American experiment to kind of build this super soldier. So it kind of hints at Captain America, kind of a deconstruction of that. But what the story really becomes about is the home life of this boy and his mother when he was younger, and his father returning from World War II, a bit of a broken man. And it becomes a story about the home life that occurs there, where the father returns and is very abusive, and the mother is trying her best to hold the family together, and the young boy, Billy, is trying his best just to survive and to make sense of what his father has become since coming home from the war. And so it creates this really interesting perspective on what monsters are. On the front, it kind of front loads it as the monster being this grotesque Frankenstein monster that gets created through this experiment. But you quickly learn the monster is actually the war and the impact that it has on this family and what that family is left with in the wake of that. It's really really beautiful, well done. Like, his artistic style is extremely high detail. So, like, there are panels in it and pages in it that you know just took months of cross-hatching. It's all just pure ink and, you know, white space. And it's really impactful to me. There were times when I had to put it down just because of the gravitas and the heaviness and how hard it kind of impacted me as a reader. And there are painfully few books that had that effect on me. And so that is why I think Monsters by Barry Windsor Smith. Oh, and he's also a UK national. He's born in the UK. So there's another tip for all of our UK listeners. Be biased towards his book.
Brilliant. You are right. You did that with 25 seconds to go, actually. So, you know,
it does go by fast.
That was pretty fast. Love the sound of that. Let's come back and talk about it very shortly. You can have a little break now, Jason. You can have a rest. Christine, I'm resetting the clock, putting 3 minutes back on for you to tell us about the Copenhagen trilogy. Over to you.
Well, so I guess I have a kind of opposite selling point, which is not it was so good I had to put it down, but it was so good I couldn't put it down. I'll tell you a little bit about what the Copenhagen trilogy is. It's three memoirs by Tove Ditlevsen, who was a Danish poet and writer. The first two volumes were originally published in 1967. And the last in 1971. And they were recently translated, I think, first in the UK by Penguin and more recently here in the States by FSG. The book is pretty amazing. At first, you kind of think you're reading just an ordinary bildungsroman about an artist. Kind of, you see in the childhood volume, she's a little girl kind of growing up and misunderstood by her family and having, you know, adventures that a child has. And then she discovers her talent for poetry and her love of poetry. And then through these series of accidents, she finds her way into the literary world. But then in the third volume, this man enters her life, and it really is like we meet the devil. You know, it's like the book just kind of goes through this door, and her life just goes through this door, and we go through it, and there's just like no ground. There's no floor there, and everything just starts falling. You know, and she becomes, because of this man, she becomes addicted to Demerol. And the last, you know, maybe quarter of the book is just this like freight train of just kind of horror, you know. And like, because Ditlevsen is this incredibly gifted poet, the images are just so vivid. So it's like, you know, like somebody's eyes are like clear, like they've just been washed, or somebody's dressed like they just came out of a burning building. So there's like the level of language is just like extraordinary. And then just what happens is so spellbinding that you can't put it down. And when I was finishing the book, I was finishing it on the subway, and I got to my stop in the spring and I had 30 pages left. And I did something that I don't think I've ever done before, which is I stood on the street to finish it, you know, because I was like, I am so transfixed. And, you know, my mom was at home with my baby, and I was like, I can't go home and like have to interact with people and get into this other headspace. Like, I have to stay here in this like gothic fairy tale. And I think she's like an extraordinary writer. And there's something about the way she does addiction and like the sort of transcendence of the drug, but also it's like real horror that I just like, I when I finished the book, I was actually kind of trembling. Like, it's actually physically shaking. And I do think that is really what I'm looking for in a book. Like, I'm really looking to like be totally rocked by it physically and just like learn new things about what it is to be a human being. So that's the Copenhagen trilogy.
Brilliant. Oh, you brought it in 2 seconds under the wire, Christine. Yes. Like some sort of pro. Wow. Well done. Thank you both for those fantastic pitches. Jason, I love a graphic novel. Oh, I tell you what, I'm doing an event this evening, actually, on the eve of recording this, about a new graphic novel. I got into them when I was 10, I think, 2000 AD, and just find them just wonderful pieces of art and literature, like the combination of everything. But I haven't heard of Monsters. So you said it was 30 years in the making. Is it relatively new?
Oh, yes. It came out in April. Like, it is fresh, hot off the presses.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's interesting because he's a bit of a reclusive. He reminds me of Cormac McCarthy. You know, he doesn't do many interviews. He doesn't show up for things. And, like, he goes on radio silence for literally like 7 years, and then it's like, boom, here's a book, bye bye, for another 7 years. And wow. It's like, how do you do okay. that? It's wow. so cool.
So is this, are you taking a leaf out of this book and just you're just not going to turn up for a few things now, Jason, going forward?
That's the goal, right? Yeah. That's the goal of writing, to just get that status where you can just publish a book and disappear just, and then come back 10 years later and publish another one. It'd be so good.
But I mean, the fact that it has taken, you know, 30 years or more than 30 years to arrive, and the way you describe that sort of high detail, like the inking and everything, gosh, I just, it's made me just want to see it. You know, like I'm sort of desperate to see it and read the story, which it sounds like a very sort of different story to what you'd assume a graphic novel is about as well, I think. Sounds pretty original.
Yeah, it is. It's very original. It is very grim and very dark. Like I say, it's meant to, I mean, the title says it all, and I think it's easy to underestimate that title. I think people often equate graphic novels with comic books, and rightfully yeah. so sometimes. But the graphic novel space is such a unique way of interacting with the brain and the emotions and the body of the reader that it affected me in ways that few books ever have. Like I say, it's rare for me to get a book where I need to put it down and just kind of like decompress and yeah. Kind of get back to where I was. And I love that. Like, that's the thing I really liked about it, where it's like, I need to stop for now. And I love the fact that I need to stop.
Yeah, I know. That's amazing. And I really love what you said about the title as well, of being, you know, of us on the surface thinking that the soldier that's come back from war, the dad is the monster, but actually no, like we've got to relook at what that means and what's caused it and what's the actual monster there. I love it. Fantastic. That sounded really great. Thank you so much for that. And I'll be honest with you, I think, Christine, this the Copenhagen trilogy sounds equally incredible. I mean, the fact that you stood on the street corner to finish it, that you were trembling at the end, all these things, like, I mean, that's an amazing thing to happen, right? That's an incredible experience.
It's just crazy what some people can do with language, you know? Like, I could not, I mean, this doesn't have to be about me, but I could not do with language what Tove Ditlevsen did with language. It astonishes me.
And the third volume, the 1971 volume, where we, as you said, meet the devil, is that the one that is just like, you know, unputdownable, or are they all like that?
I think that they're all really gripping, and they're short. So the whole book, I think, is like 350 pages. So each individual volume is, you know, like a kind of novella. So it doesn't, it's not, you know, like reading a 1,000-page memoir or something. I think that there, I felt like I was totally committed to the book, and then it took this left turn and took me into like a totally different place.
I mean, it sounds brilliant. I want to read both of these. And the, you know,
yeah, I want to read Monster now too. It sounds incredible.
Yeah, and I want to read these books that you know left you feeling like that, Christine, and you know this amazing language that she uses and everything. Oh. But I got it. I can only pick one. I can only pick one for the book off.
High stakes situation.
Oh, high stakes, and you know,
what do we win?
You win pride.
That's a great question, Christine. What do we win?
You win the pride of winning. Is that good enough? No, that does. I get the sense that wasn't the answer you were both looking for.
Yeah, winning the prize can be very ominous. It could be a very ominous thing. No one tells you what you're winning. She's like, you won the prize.
I remember.
Like, okay, do I get to get murdered tomorrow by someone?
Yeah, exactly. The prize. ... It's like, okay. I remember an author a couple of series ago said, "Oh, I want to win the, you know, the bell," and I was like, "There's no way you're getting these. These are very precious. No. Yeah. No chance, mate." I think it's almost a draw, if I'm honest, and I'm not just saying that to you know try and stay friends, but do you know what? I'm gonna give it to Monsters, and the reason is, other than a great pitch, I think that I really do think we got to champion graphic novels a little bit more. I think we should try and put them into the hands of more readers, because I do think there's, as you sort of alluded to, Jason, there's a comic booky, you know, thing that people think, oh, it's just, you know, kid stuff or whatever. And it's like, no. Like when you get the right thing, which sounds like Monsters is, it's an amazing piece of literature. But, Christine, I've already written down the Copenhagen Trilogy because I'm going to be ordering it now. So, you know.
You know, don't even bother. Sort of won. Don't even, just like, you know, just forget it. Just forget it. You like Jason's book better. It's fine. Oh, no, I'm just kidding. I totally want to read it too. So I thought.
That's mine and Christine's relationship. Over with now. Never mind.
You're dead to me.
It was a good friendship for 45 minutes. I mean, hey. Hell of a Book by Jason Mott is out now. It's published by Trapeze, and The Life of the Mind by Christine Smallwood is also out. It's published by Europa Editions. I could talk about these books all day. I could talk with both of you all day, but we've come to the end of our time, and it's been an absolute pleasure. Jason, Christine, thanks so much for being here and for taking Buying Book Off.
Terrific. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.